Like, what little kid doesn't want to grow up and do commando stuff one day? You know, it's like, oh yeah, I get to go hang out with Peter Pan and the Lost Boys for a little bit. Yeah, let's do that.
Welcome to the WFO Life Podcast. Buckle up for interviews, insights, and practical discussions, and the occasional intellectual oddity, all designed to help you master self, master craft, and accomplish any life mission. Welcome back to the WFO Life Podcast. In this episode, we get into our second half of the interview with Tyson Stahl. As you recall, Tyson was a young man that was involved in music and all kinds of varied backgrounds as a youth. Then he became a star football player with the U.S. Naval Academy. Then he went on to become a Marine officer. And in this second half, we get into some really cool aspects of his history where he decided to go into special operations. We also get into some of his details of his combat deployments. We also discuss Spartan Leadership Program, which he's been involved with, as well as the Travis Manion Foundation. And especially fun is we get into the final stages of this episode. We talk about Silence and Light, which is a band he's been involved with other veterans. They raise money to support veterans organizations. And it's really a cool discussion about the origin of that band and the work that they do. So I hope you will enjoy this insightful, inspiring interview with Tyson Stahl.
Was going through experience like that, and obviously you had some combat between that we could talk about a little bit, but, you know, did that, I guess, kind of sow the seeds for you later to, you know, once you'd been in infantry for a while and MARSOC was, you know, a thing, then you're like, hey, you know, what's the next thing where I can be with a bunch of cool dudes doing cool stuff, right? I mean, was that, I mean, what was your, I guess, impetus to want to, you know, do something, you know, maybe even more challenging at that point in your career?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, really, I saw it as a chance to, you know, like there's this next level, right? Like I want to go to, I at least want to try and see if I'm good enough to be there. Right.
Yeah.
And actually at that point, so at the point I put in my package to go to the assessment and selection, I was also considering leaving the Marine Corps. I was on a B billet. You know, I had done two deployments to Iraq as a platoon commander, one as part of the surge and then another in like a pretty peaceful time in 08-09, and mm-hmm. went to the School of Infantry East to just kind of ride out the rest of my 5-year commitment. And my buddy that I told you about, who I met on the PFT, he and another friend, both squad mates from IOC, were in one of the early individual training course classes for MARSOC. And so they kept trying to, you know, just tell me and my buddy, like, dude, just put in a packet, go to the selection. And so I had a resignation letter written up and also submitted my paperwork for the selection. And when I got to the selection and passed, you know, after a couple weeks, I remember just thinking, like, I have to do this. Like, this is where it's at, you know, like, it was, I think some of it was built on the stories of the guys that I knew. I mean, there was a platoon commander who was like a series ahead of me I was at 1st Battalion, 2nd Marines when I was a platoon commander. And my buddy there, took one of the early teams into Northwestern Afghanistan. And, you know, just the stories of the stuff those guys were doing was just incredible, man. I mean, just literally, you know, it's used over and over again, right? But this whole concept of just being amongst giants. And that was, you know, and I don't want this to sound like the infantry community is not that. And I only say that because that's where I came from, but I worked with some really incredible guys, you know, Marines and sailors at 1-2 and was exposed to a lot of really incredible infantry officers and staff NCOs and NCOs and junior Marines when I was there. But then when I saw the people that were at MARSOC, I said, man, like these guys are masters educated, you know, E7s and E8s who are crushing it, you know. And by the time I got there, you know, the rank structure kind of slid left by like one, mm-hmm. you know, it had sort of grown out of the old force reconnaissance, you know, platoon model. But I mean, dude, the guys I went through ITC with, were like rock stars, man. And, yeah. and just be, you know, it's like what I said at the end of SLP, you know, to be in a place where you just feel constantly elevated and pushed and mm-hmm. as a leader feeling supported
yeah.
all the time, you know, by your people, that are counting on you to, you know, buy the bombs, as I used to say, like, that's it's just unreal, man. And having autonomy as a small unit leader with legitimate implications in the larger, you know, strategic plan.
Sure.
Dude, that's just, it's like, you know, and like what little kid doesn't want to grow up and do commando stuff one day?
Right.
yeah. yeah. It's like, oh yeah, I get to go hang out with Peter Pan and the Lost Boys for a little bit. Yeah. Let's do that.
Yeah, that was just reminding me, you had we had interviewed Eric Davis a little while back. He former Navy SEAL, and mm-hmm. He said something very similar about SEAL communities and it sounds very similar. I'm not 100%, you know, familiar with why they started MARSOC and things like that, but it sounds very similar. You talked about if you get a guy, you know, elite people who are trying to push themselves to be the best, you put them all in the same room, everybody's trying to give 120%. It's not a sum of their parts, it's a synergistic amplification of what you can accomplish. So everybody feels superhuman in that environment because everybody's giving 110%, not for themselves, but for their brothers next to them. And that's a huge uplifting thing. In fact, he mentioned that once he left the military out of that environment, it's a huge transition because everything slows back down. It's like, wow, this yeah. is how normal life is. I have to do everything myself. yeah. It's kind of cool that you mentioned that, but can you back up for people that maybe don't, the MARSOC, why was that started? Cause I mean, Marines, I view, I'm non-military, but I view that as a fairly elite, you know, branch of the military anyway, but why did the military start in a special forces specifically for the Marines?
Sure. So, you know, I guess the legend goes, and I say legend and somebody will hear this and say, no, it's truth. And I think it is true, but yeah. I think, you know, when the U.S. Special Operations Command was formally established, the Marine Corps is actually invited to be a part of it. Like the Marine Corps as a whole was invited to be a part of it. And it was turned down, which is like the most Marine Corps shit ever.
nah.
Yeah.
We're all right.
Yeah. And you know, because the Marine Corps is, you know, America's shock troop, right? I mean, you have a fully enabled Marine infantry battalion, like ready to go smash whatever needs to be smashed within 72 hours anywhere in the world, right? Like yeah. constantly ready. And I'm not talking about like precision strike force. I'm talking like blunt force trauma. Like we're gonna establish the toehold here for the larger force to come in.
Right.
And so, you know, and that's what I loved about the infantry. I mean, it was like, you know, playing high school football again. It was just a bunch of rambunctious, you know, dudes in their late teens, early 20s, just like going haywire. And you know, with jets and helos and Artie and everything else that comes with
it. Yeah, it's like we're gonna go here, we're gonna kill everybody. Got it? Okay, ready, break.
And so anyway, you know, you fast forward to the global war on terror, and I want to say it was around 03, 04 timeframe. There was a push because special operations units were just spread super thin between right, Afghanistan right. and Iraq. And they established what was called US SOCOM Marine Corps Detachment One, and everybody just calls it Det One now, or the Det. They screened the entire Marine Corps. It wasn't just force reconnaissance guys. They screened the entire Marine Corps to put about 40 or so, you know, seasoned, capable communicators, intel guys, whatever, you know, pick your MOS to create this capable, you know, troop size strike force to go out and augment, really kind of tier one, tier two special operations capacity, you know, overseas. And they went and they operated, you know, with great effect and had a positive response. But by and large, I think, you know, SOCOM was so well established that a lot of folks were like, nah, you know, we don't need to do that. And eventually Donald Rumsfeld said, no, you're doing it. Like Marine Corps, you're doing it. And, right. So that was it. So they stood it up and they took from, you know, cause traditionally the force reconnaissance, companies were sort of the Marine Expeditionary Force, you know, sort of the largest unit in the order of battle for you know, sort of the MAGTAF concept was Marine Air Ground Task Force. It was, you know, you had your direct action and special reconnaissance units tied into the force reconnaissance company, so they could go, you know, do you know, Greenset urban reconnaissance. They also went, but they were going to a lot of the same schools that the SEALs and the Rangers, right, and the Green Berets and stuff were going to for you know, very unique sort of special access program kind of things. And so they took first and second force reconnaissance company on the East and West Coast. And then a third group called the Foreign Military Training Unit that was at Camp Lejeune, who was kind of like a foreign military advisor unit, and created first, second, and third Marine Special Operations Battalion in I think it was 07. And, mm-hmm. and you know, and the rest is history. So it's a very young, you know, we're a very young organization. I mean, I think I was like the sixth individual training course class, maybe, or so. But yeah, so that's where it came from and why.
Yeah, so I think I told you, I think one of my classmates at TBS was either in Det One or one of the first team leaders in those, you know, mm-hmm. first battalions. And Mike Seeley, I think, mm-hmm. was, and I remember just that dude was, you know, as much as you could be a legend at TBS and be a student, you know, he was that guy, especially then where a lot of the instructors in 01, 02 didn't have a lot of combat experience, you know. He checks in his alpha as a second lieutenant, and he's got a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star with V and a, you know, a combat action ribbon with a star. And then like, they're doing the math. They're like, how did you go to combat in two different places, you know, in the last like 10 years, you know? And he's just like, he's like, I can't talk about it, you know? So,
Well, yeah. So he was in my brother's IOC class, and I remember Hoot telling me about him.
Yeah.
You know, because I, if I'm not mistaken, he was a force reconnaissance Marine when he was enlisted. Yeah. But yeah, you know, and the coolest part for me was, you know, a lot of the senior staff NCOs and some of the senior officers when I got there, but it was mostly the staff NCOs, man. They were the plank owners, and there were some, you know, Det One guys in that mix.
Yeah.
You know, the Marines who put me through the individual training course, you know, and taught me how to shoot and taught me how to be a ground force commander and taught me how to be an officer in that organization, you know, were the plank owners. And like, when I look back with that, man, I mean, to have learned from those guys, right, who had everything to lose, you know, and to have them trust me enough to then go out and be a ground force commander in their unit and, you know, be the one to you know, ultimately kind of have the, you know, the success and failure right on my shoulders, so to speak. You know, it was so humbling. I mean, truly, and I can't say enough about it, because, you know, to this day, I keep in touch with a lot of the guys that I served with there. And you know, I've been out 4 years now, you know, 4.5 years. And it's great because I've been out almost as long as I was there now, you know, yeah, it's so, just such an amazing place.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, the grit and the culture change with Navy football. And, you know, you talked a little bit about, you know, the culture of, you know, becoming an infantry officer and then going to MARSOC. I guess, what are some like commonalities that you maybe saw in those challenging but successful cultures?
I mean, it really just comes down to, you know, the team first, right? You know, and, yeah. And it's never about me. You know, I personally believe that the role of an officer in a unit like that, I think the role of a coach, I think the role of a team captain, you know, and we throw around servant leadership a lot, right? And Chris, you've been subject to these conversations, but truly it's not necessarily about being a servant leader as much as it is about serving the unit, right? Serving your teammates, being meeting and exceeding that team standard over and over and over again, right? If you exceed it on Monday, well, now the bar is just that much higher, right? So I got to exceed it on Tuesday and then on Wednesday. Sure. And when you do that, right? Like, yeah, there's always like the fun competition piece, but man, imagine the trust in the room when everyone around you is like, I got to work better today. And,
yeah.
You know, I used to go back to the Naval Academy, you know, right before I left the Marine Corps and do a combat leadership talk with members of the junior class, Naval Leadership 310. And eventually I got to do it for like the whole section, you know, twice a year. Yeah, it was cool. And I used that opportunity to share with them the things that I screwed up over the years, you know, because I got a lot of shit wrong. You know, I mean, we all do.
Well, that's how you learn, right? Don't share the good stuff. Share the, hey, this was painful. Don't do this.
Yeah. And I would always tell them, like, look, man, you're in a place that's like full of stories of success and heroism and all this kind of stuff. Like, I'm just going to like bear it all and tell you where I like, you know, screwed up on a handful of things and open myself up a little bit. But one of the things that I really tried to go back to is like, you know, you've got the Marine Corps used to throw around the term, the strategic corporal, right? And,
oh yeah,
you know, and I think we pay it a lot of lip service, but man, at every level during my time, at every unit, I had guys who were coming in and doing things that were so mind blowing to me that I was like, I am not working hard enough. Like I got to,
especially for their age and rank, especially for their age and rank and level of responsibility. Right.
Yeah. And then to realize that, like, dude, this, you know, 19-year-old or this 28-year-old, you know, staff sergeant or this 32-year-old gunny, who's my team chief, like, these guys are getting better at everything they do every day, not because they want me to put it on their fit rep, but because they want us to kick ass, you know? And that's like that type of inspired leadership. Once that, you know, started happening, like, I was just a ball of fire, man. Like I felt like I could never keep up, you know, and I mean that in the best way possible. It's just dude, I gotta, you know, but then you can truly then start looking up and out, you know, as the officer and saying like, all right, well, we want to do this mission long-term. Like, how can I sell us to be able to be the guys that do this? Right. Or, you know, we're short on this stuff. Like I need to go make the case for this stuff because, you know, my best time in the Marine Corps was being a ground force commander for a Marine Special Operations team. And, you know, rarely did that ever put me you know, in the stack. If I was in the stack, I was wrong. I mean, look, if you're an officer in the Marine Corps in an infantry unit and you think the point of friction is the breach, you're wrong. I'm just telling you. And to just do the battle drill of like getting the, you know, just getting the feedback, getting the information, and the way we worked, I feel warm inside thinking about it, you know, because it was incredible. And it was direct, you know, we had our, you know, my team chief and I, who are still very close, you know, he told everyone to get out of the team room one day after a debrief. And I thought for sure I was going to get my nose broken, but, you know, but, you know, we were at that level, you know, and where you can have those moments. And then 4 minutes later, you know, we walk out laughing and, you know, grab ass. And then the team's like, what is going on with these two?
well, you know, what's funny is like, you know, I think people have this view of the, especially in the Marine Corps, this very rigid, you know, it's always yes sir, no sir, you know, type. And there is, I guess, a place for that. But I remember, you know, in a completely different world in the Marine Corps, when I was a captain and a major, having like brand new lieutenants coming to me and be like, hey, sir, I just want to let you know that I think I might be writing up a charge sheet on the staff sergeant or the gunny, you know, about him being insubordinate, you know. And I'm just like, you know, I take a good 5 or 10 second pause and before I respond. And I'm just like, you know, and then I would go into the Socratic method, right? You know, I'm asking them, so, you know, tell me about the scenario. And, you know, it reminds me of some of the stuff we learned. And, you know, we can probably get to the program that you and I, met each other through that was awesome. But it's just about knowing yourself. And, you know, Jocko talks about it a lot, you know, having humility. It's like, you know, if you're at the point, you know, as a leader in general, and especially as a military officer, and you're going to write up your like right hand man for being insubordinate, you know, you might want to look in the mirror first before you start, you know, judging. So it's kind of interesting, you know, you have to, you know, whether it's a marriage, whether it's, you know, being a business manager, you know, you have to be able to be frank with each other, especially if you're going to do good things. And, you know, and obviously preparing to go into the worst parts of the world and do bad things to bad people, you know, that's the last environment that you need to hold back. So that was important to go through. So real quick, not that it has to be real quick, but you talked about you did some deployments to Iraq, one, I guess, more challenging than the other one. Maybe just talk about, you know, the wave tops of some, you know, things that you saw, you know, because obviously once you experience combat for the first time, you know, my experiences in a combat environment were very different than you. But, you know, either, you know, no matter what your job is or where you're at on the battlefield, it's never exactly like you trained for. You know, and I think some things are better, some things are worse. And so maybe just talk to us a little bit about the wave tops of that kind of going from a, you know, a very good training and challenging training environment into doing it for real.
Yeah. So, you know, I think one of the, I always compare it to what I consider like relationship, like new relationship rule number one, which is like, you can never unsee or unhear anything.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So, you know, but, combat's much the same, you know, and I'll compare it to, you know, the infantry officer course was under a lot of scrutiny for a long time about its standards and all that kind of stuff. And I think a lot of times when you look at what the standards are for IOC, it's easy to look at them, you know, the hikes and everything else is like being very antiquated, right? You know,
it's like unnecessary, right? So
yeah, you know, troops aren't moving on foot, you know, 20 miles to establish a defensive position anymore. You know, and that's not to say that they won't one day, but I think more than that, IOC is such a great school because it pushes your mind and your body and your emotions to the extent possible to then put you in a decision-making scenario when you're completely frazzled.
Sure. Yeah.
Because they can't,
you got to manufacture. Yeah. They can't shoot at you. They got to manufacture chaos, right? Friction.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and so I think with combat, you know, it's very easy to get tunnel vision, you know, especially the first couple times you experience it. You know, and I talk about being a ground force commander. I mean, the GFC's role is to, I call it, you know, manage the chaos, right? You've got your small unit leaders that are driving the fight, man. I mean, if those infantry, you know, squad leaders and platoon sergeant are like, you got to worry about keeping up, you know? And, but knowing where they are, knowing where the threats are, you know, sort of analyzing the battlefield in a 3D sort of context and, you know, who's injured, where are they, what's the status, you know, am I tracking everything, what do we have available now organically, what assets should I request, how am I going to employ them, what are the geometries, JTAC, what, you know, what's the you know, weaponeering solution for you know, this type of target or that type of target. And it's your brain, you know, as a ground force commander, is like, you're just,
I think people have this idea from the movies, and it is like, it, you know, obviously there's kinetic pieces of it and there's the threat of danger and, you know, dealing with casualties, but I think people underestimate the thinking involved with that type of scenario.
Yeah. It's, you know, and in Afghanistan, we used to joke about, like, you know, just like being in like a gentleman's gunfight, you know, where it's like a couple hundred meters and you're just taking pop shots at each other. You know, and it's like fun and games until it, like, I mean, I remember we were in this one fight and there was a huge open space between the building we were in. I mean, it was like a giant cross compartmental danger area. And we were not going to be able to maneuver on it. We had another unit that we could try and maneuver on it, but they had to like clear through part of this bill as well, and we could see these guys, you know, and they're shooting and we're, you know, just turkey peeking over this wall and shooting back, and you could feel their rounds hitting the wall in front of us. And I've got this video of I'm sitting there and I'm working with my JTAC and I'm referencing my GRG because we're just trying to like pinpoint where these guys are, maybe we can put some ordnance on them or something. And I'm just feeling, you know, these rounds hit the wall, and then my ops chief pokes his head up, and all of a sudden, like, the wall in front of him explodes, and I'm thinking, dude, he just got shot in the face, and he didn't. I don't know where that round went. But, you know, we're like super, you know, nonchalant after kind of the adrenaline's worn off, like dudes are trying not to take naps and stuff. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's like, oh shit. Yeah. It's right. Those are actual bullets. You know?
This is serious.
Yeah. You know, and you know, there's just those lulls but you know, but then there were other times where it was like, you know, in a single radio transmission, I'm calling in a CASAVAC for, you know, a casualty, you know, with a gunshot wound, and notifying higher that I'm about to put a hellfire on, you know, some dudes that are engaging us with an RPG and a machine gun. You know, and simultaneously I got another group of dudes putting mortars on another group of bad guys, and then we're trying to get another unit flanking a squad dug into a trench line. So, you know, it's like, and that's all happening at once.
Layers and layers. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, so it's, but we had done the rehearsal, right? We had done the battle drill for those things. And actually after one pretty complex engagement, I remember one of the guys near me was like, man, that was just like this one exercise we did. You know, we're like the staff had thrown everything at us.
Yeah. That's nice.
Yeah. And I think really what it comes down to, kind of back to your question, Chris, is like, you know, it's not what you think it is. Sometimes it's completely underwhelming in a way, because it's like, oh, like, here I am now, you know, I always joke. It's like, you think you're just going to like walk through some like invisible plane and now like the world's completely different, but no, it's just like a lot of loud noise and some chaos and, you know, your adrenaline is a very real factor, you know, and you just got to be cool with it. And I feel fortunate that I'm a guy who has always just been able to be very calm in conflict. But, you know, kind of back to, you know, what you guys were saying earlier. I mean, there is, when I think back to that experience when I was 16, 17, you know, 18 years old with my best friend being sick and then watching him pass away, you know, and in some of the research I've been doing, frankly, recently, like I recognize that sort of that ability to be calm when things are just completely out of control, is a very natural sort of, I guess, side effect or byproduct of having those experiences at a young age, you know, and just being able to just rationally put emotion aside for a minute and just make the decisions that have to be made.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. You know, you talking about that, dealing with loss and some of that, you know, you talk about being calm in those situations. One of the things I was thinking about, and, you know, I've dealt with that, you know, in the job I have now, well, in a different way, but the point I'm trying to make is, I don't know if you feel the same way, but I feel like now I actually deal better with worse situations, and I get anxious in situations that I probably shouldn't, you know, and it's weird. I don't know what that is. I mean, I don't know. And obviously you've gone through a lot of, you know, things that I've never experienced, but I think just being a Marine and having been in, you know, some pretty chaotic, you know, compromising situations, I feel like, you know, well, one of my kids gets hurt, or, you know, if something happens and the car breaks down in bad weather or whatever, I actually force myself to calm down, and I can deal with that better than sometimes I have to give a brief on one slide that I've briefed a million times before. And, you know, right before I'm going to get up there to get, I get like more heart palpitations and anxiety for that than when like real shit is happening. So I don't know if like, what is that? I mean, I don't know if you have similar experiences or, you know, what do you have to think about that? But.
Yeah, well, you know, and I think this is your show, but I'm gonna go ahead and presume that this is actually a really good segue into kind of the transition discussion. Yeah. Because, you know, when I left, I was, you know, I won't say it was a wreck, but my just ability to adapt to where I was just. Every day was different. I moved back to my hometown. So like I had friends around, I had family around, you know, I had access to everything I ever, you could ever need, like literally the best case scenario for somebody leaving the military. And I just, you know, I didn't know what my expectations were.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, leading up to that, there had been sort of this pattern of me, just kind of being short fused, you know, and recently I've learned a lot about the impact of trauma and stress on the nervous system, and sort of where we exist in you know, the concept of polyvagal theory, which is, you know, relatively new. And dude, and this is like all very new knowledge for me. And it has been, totally game changing and sort of understanding myself and why I can be short fused at times and why I can be shut down at times. Right. And just sort of, you know, they sort of reference it as the ladder, right. Of your nervous system, you know, between safe and social, flight and fight, and being shut down, and sort of recognizing that when you spend so much time in a place where you are just existing at that high alert, you know, at the ready, that becomes normal for your body, you know, and that's, you know, and that's not normal to be there all the time. Right. We should be, you know, we should be safe, and we should feel comfortable in our surroundings, you know, and you know, being able to sort of recognize that. Now, you know, I'm like, oh, you know, I become aware when I'm like insistent that I sit with my back, you know, to the corner of the room so I can see that, you know, all the entrances and exits, you know, and it's like, you don't have to ask somebody to switch places with you, you know, and somebody, right. you know, listening probably thinks I'm like, I've like lost my edge now because of it. But like, I mean, like, I don't want to live that way anymore. You know,
I think
like,
this is the point I'm going to open the beer now, I think.
But you know, but there is, you know, there's evidence that points to, you know, existing in that place for a long time, whether it's a deployment, whether it's years of your life because of multiple deployments, you know, and that sort of interperiod, you know, where you don't necessarily have enough time to normalize your relationships that were put on pause for 6, 7, 9 months at a time, you know, and so you just kind of live in this flighty nature and then go right back overseas. You know, that's where a lot of that comes from, I think. And that's what I've started learning. And it's, you know, I think it's important stuff to try and get to the bottom of, though, because, you know, and sometimes it's just us being crotchety, you know, people as well, you know, we can just be moody.
Men of a certain age that did cool shit once upon a time. And, you know, so.
Yeah.
But that whole cortisol thing, though, is a big deal. I mean, it physically changes the brain. I mean, it's not normal for humans to have cortisol coursing through their veins at a high level for very long periods of time. It's just not. And what, you know, and also when you were talking about that, you know, kind of things, you know, super focus and those kind of things that may be combat. And, you know, I have nothing like that in my life, with the exception I was in, you know, did a lot of ER work and stuff. And I can, I know what that feels like when really critical things happen. I can remember what things look like in people's bodies from very intense moments. And it's like, as if it was yesterday. It's like right now I can remember that. But what happens, everything slows down. Like Chris was talking about, he goes, I've just been a guy that can be calm like that. I think it's an ability to, I think it's cortisol and adrenaline doing what it's supposed to do in the human mind.
Yeah.
It brings you where you're supposed to be to make good, clear decisions. Some people, that stuff hits them and they, you know, they can't respond, you know, with anything but emotion or fear or whatever. So I think that's a good, it's a trait probably of a great soldier or whatever, you know, to be able to focus. But that cortisol, it's interesting. Do you think more people, I mean, well, I know there's a lot of people that are dealing with that transition into like civilian life. It's like, I imagine the tools to try to transition slowly or normally are just not always there for everyone.
Yeah. So that's, man, you may have just opened a can of worms here, but you know, I have an opinion on this. Mm-hmm. It is really easy to allow yourself to feel like there are no available resources.
Okay.
And it is also really easy to become dejected or feel jaded become jaded. I'm not sure which applies to which at this point, but you know, when you have an experience, you know, where you go to talk to somebody and it feels intrusive, you know, and you're like, I just don't want to talk about this stuff right now. And, you know, and then they just offer to prescribe you medication and no, I don't want that either. Right. You know, you either want to psychoanalyze me or give me, you know, a fire hose to put out a candle right now. And I'm not interested in either one of those. You know, I want to do this on my own time. And then to never follow up, though. Right. Because that can be a bad experience. And that's not the other person's fault. You know, that's not the professional's fault. You know, that it was a bad experience. And I do think that there is a propensity to go back to that self-sustaining survival self who's like, you know, I survived all that stuff. Like, I don't need this. Right. I can do this myself.
Right.
And that's when it gets really dark for people.
Yeah.
Because that's when that heavier dark cloud starts to keep you in that hyper alert place for a long time, you know, and where I do think there is a gap is in the education for people who are transitioning. And I don't even think it's necessarily relative to only combat veterans. I mean, look, the military is a very high stress place.
Sure.
Insert like great opportunity for an Air Force joke, but I won't do it. I say that, you know, fully joking. I really appreciate, everybody who's willing to just step out and do it. But to just understand like what you might experience, how do you do that? You know, like you go through a transition readiness, you know, in the Marine Corps, it's like a 5-day class for, you know, you got dozens of people a week getting out. Most of them don't even have a high school diploma, you know, or they've got a GED or equivalent. Right. But they don't have a college degree. They came straight from, you know, in some cases they came from a bad family situation and they have no place to go. And, you know, like, dude, you gotta reinforce that first. Right. You know, and I'm sitting here with a college degree and, you know, this, that, and the other. And like, I'm the best case scenario for somebody who's going to transition and survive. And so I think the military has prioritized, right. I mean, there's a level of triage there associated with, you know, where do we want to put the emphasis? And I also think there's a ton of great veteran service organizations out there, you know, nonprofits that will help people get over it. But at the end of the day, like, you got to be willing to do the work. You got to show up every day. You have to look yourself in the mirror and say, look, I don't like where I am right now. I have to do some things that will make me uncomfortable to fix that and to get to where I want to be. It's not about changing yourself. It's not because you're broken. It's just about understanding where you've been and how it's made you arrive at where you are, right? Because a lot of those experiences, especially after you've been away from the military for a while and not with people where, you know, talking about gunfights, you know, over lunch is normal, you know, like you feel isolated very quickly. This is actually how I got involved with the Travis Manion Foundation was, I'd been working at the MARSOC Foundation when I first left active duty and saw this incredible space full of these organizations that do just that. So, you know, long answer to your question, but, I don't think that there aren't enough resources. What I do think there is a shortage of are leaders and people who empower those members of their units who are getting out to let them know that it's okay to feel uncomfortable and to be vulnerable enough to go find that help, you know, when the time comes, you know, and that's hard because that's not, you know, quantifiable. And I think that's what makes that such a tough topic. I'm saying this from the perspective of a guy who's had to do it, you know, again, being in the best case scenario and still feeling like I'm living in a silo, you know, 1200 feet underground. So,
Yeah. You know, Tyson, some of the people that, we either know personally or, you know through the media that have been best on this is like General Mattis, you know, talking about post-traumatic growth and, you know, Tosh, really being, you know, very outspoken and, you know, and some people would maybe say harsh about it, but I remember him telling us that, he's like, you know, regardless of what you think, the military doesn't really owe you anything, you know? And so he talks about the entitlement mentality, which was surprising. I'd never really thought about it like that, but it ties in exactly to what you're saying is like, you have to be both as a leader in a unit to lead these people to help, but also you have to look yourself in the mirror and come to terms with saying, hey, all these things I did that made me strong, you know, might not get me through this. So I need to be strong enough to ask for help. I need to be strong mm-hmm. enough to ask, to realize it's okay to not be okay and tell somebody about that. So I think that, you know, General Mattis with the post-traumatic growth and some of the classes and the new, you know, I guess treatment opportunities that kind of talk about that. And then with somebody like Tosh saying, you know, looking veterans in the eye up in his ranch and saying, hey, you know, regardless of what you think, you know, it's on you. In a lot of cases to, like you said, the resources are there, but you still have to, you know, be connected with it or, you know, to admit when you need help, which, you know, there's a leadership piece to that. And there's like a look at yourself in the mirror, you know, piece to that. And I think that, you know, I think too often in certain circles, the woe is me mentality, you know, seems like the right way to go about it, but that's probably not the case.
Yeah, you know, one of I'm not one to necessarily just remember random quotes from a classroom setting, but two of the quotes that have stuck with me from my time at the infantry officer course. The first one was the school director, then Major Wetterauer. I think he's a colonel or maybe a one star now, but you know, he said, this place has nothing to do with you. It has everything to do with your Marines, you know, and that's been written inside of every notebook I've ever had. But then the other thing was Tosh, when we were talking about combat, right. And kind of having one of those, kneecap to kneecap sort of discussions. And he said this again, when we saw him, back in the fall, he said, you are a product of your circumstances. You're not a slave to them, right? Your experiences, rather. You're a product of your experiences. You're not a slave to them, right? Yeah. And I always come back to the William Ernest Henley poem Invictus. You know, I always get it backwards, but I think it's, I'm the master of my fate. I'm the captain of my soul, you know? And just that final push has to come from within, you know? There's 1,000 adages about it, right? You can lead a horse to water. You know, there's been Grammys given out for country songs that deliver this message, and we miss it, you know, all the time. But it's that, you know, it's that personal accountability and personal ownership, and saying, look, this is me, this is my life, and I have to take control of it.
Absolutely. I mean, so many, important points, not only for military, but just for other people who might be listening, just with other, you know, just life can present these challenges to you, that you have to figure out the healthiest way to deal with it. And before I go off on another tangent, I think, you know, two more things that I for sure wanted to get to was our experience with, you know, the Spartan Leadership Program, and then talk about your continuing musical interests that, you know, you've been delving into. So I know for me, and we've talked about it, we maybe even done a whole episode about it, but, you know, we both had volunteered doing things with the Travis Manion Foundation and then applied for their first Spartan Leadership Program. And especially in a COVID environment, it wasn't ideal. You know, we kind of had a kind of a slow start, it seemed like, but once we got into some of the self-reflection, and then obviously once we went to Colorado and had our kind of graduation experience, I know for me, you know, maybe I'm always a skeptic, or, you know, not sure what I'm going to get out of things that seem too good to be true. But I think that it was another good example of, one, the organization is phenomenal, and just the people always make the difference. So, I mean, I guess I've told my story about it on here, but, you know, talk to us about, you know, what you thought or got out of that Spartan Leadership Program.
Yeah. So, you know, I was asked to apply, like, literally at the last minute. By a buddy of mine, Albie, who was out there with us. He, you know, we had met a couple years prior, and he was like, you should just really just sign, just apply, right? You can always turn it down, but just apply. you get to go spend a week with Tosh on his ranch in Colorado.
Yeah.
So
it's worth the price of admission. Yeah.
That's what got me. And honestly, like, I didn't even realize that it was going to be this like months long thing.
I
thought it was, you know, I knew that there was going to be a time investment, but I didn't realize that it was as robust as it was. And, dude, that program, truly was, very instrumental in me, I think sort of at least arriving at base camp, for this next phase of my life, right? Where I've been a couple years out of the Marine Corps, I've been steadily employed, successful, in that employment, exploring and having the time and space to explore the things that I'm interested in. And then coming to a point where I'm just sort of suddenly like lost in the mire of the day to day, right? The sure. Muckety muck. And
yeah.
Sorry, my dog here is click clacking around, if you guys can hear that. SLP was, and you nailed it, right? The sort of, once we got into that like deep introspective, essentially defining our why, thing. And for every lesson that we had, it's like every day we were in Colorado and that experience and having those conversations, and speaking those thoughts to one another in an open forum, being with one another day in and day out, with the just incredible inputs we had from from Jay to Tosh to Rex, and then the whole TMF staff. Like it was just amazing to have that. But for me, and you know this, Chris, but for me, it really reminded me what my passion is, which is to just invest myself in others. I want to help people arrive at their goals. I mean, I get such fulfillment out of that. And taking it a step further, I want to do that within the context of sports, And so I made this decision. I was going to go back to school. I was going to, get a degree in kinesiology so that I could, eventually become a collegiate, I'd like to be a Division I strength and conditioning coach, And at 38, I don't give a shit, how old I am or what, that's like, I've done everything I wanted to do in the military. Cool. I played Division I football. Awesome. Now I can take both of those experiences, right? Those 15 years of my life, 16 years, and put them together to work with young men, who are 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 years old, elite performers, elite athletes, and help define a culture for them, right? And help them figure out their why and figure out their purpose, and if I hadn't gone through SLP, I would never have arrived at that, man. Maybe I would have, but it would be years down the road, and the courage that it gave me to sort of say, like, call my CEO and say, hey, here's what's about to happen. But then to be able to do it in a way that he hears the conviction in my tone of voice and he's like, how can I help you? That was like, whoa, like an empowering moment for me. But it does, it comes back to those, every other Sunday, for 7 months, just cranking out those calls and those conversations and digging in deep with a bunch of people I had never met, before that.
Well, I think it was amazing that because we all were coming to similar realizations in our own pockets, that when we came together, even Tosh and Ryan Mannion, the president of the foundation, were just in awe like we were about how the group gelled together for the first time we were physically present with each other. Because, I mean, think about how personal that is to share, you know, what your strengths are, you know, what your passions and values are. But then, like you said, a lot of these hard life decisions that we all have to make at different, you know, crossroads, if you really look inward, like we were forced to do, and find out what you're good at naturally, you know, what your values are and what you're passionate about, like you put that all together and it's like the perfect version of what we didn't get from our high school guidance counselor, right? You know, the whole, it's like, you know, I feel like I could do a better job of that now, right? Because we, you know, life experiences plus that program, I'm like, you know, not that it's easy to go down the road, but it makes it clearer, like you said, to the point where, you know, you tell your boss or you tell your significant other or family, you're like, wow, you know, I think you're going to do this, you know, because I can, you know, feel the passion and I've seen the actions you're taking. And so I think that, you know, it couldn't have been any better of an experience than to end on the top of a mountain, you know, at Tasha's, you know, mountain getaway, you know, that was, you know, equal parts kind of challenging and, you know, physically in some ways. I mean, it'd been a while since a lot of us like slept in nature and, you know, especially at altitude, and, you know, obviously some of us in better shape had a lot more fun on the hikes and the little PT sessions than others. But I think that it all came together, and then having the graduation kind of celebration, and especially in a COVID environment, I think I said it around the campfire one time, and, you know, and I would Tosh, you know, stared through my soul like he likes to do and agreed with me. And, you know, when I just said, man, just being, you know, especially I'm as you know, the couple times we've been together, you know, I'm true to my last name. I like to talk and tell stories and feed off of other people. And I didn't realize like how much I had missed just having physical proximity to people until we got together a couple times. So I think, you know, it was healing for the soul to do that. And so, you know, hopefully we've all kept in contact some ways via, you know, technology and stuff, and, you know, hopefully have some reunion. So I'm glad you could share that with us, you know, on your piece of it. I guess last thing, you talked, you know, we'll come full circle as we get to wrap it up, but you talked about music being a part of your life early on, and then you went into sports and the military. But tell us about how you came back to the musical fold, so to speak.
Yeah, so, you know, music has been a theme, you know, throughout. I always, even when I was in college, we had a band, a bunch of us from the football team, a couple offensive linemen, one of our stud A-backs, and one of our wide receivers. We had a cover band called Oversized Load.
Good
time. Yeah, you know, so we would play, you know, parties and stuff like that. And so I you know, when you play in a rock band, you end up learning everything. So I started with a guitar. I ended up having to learn how to play bass in my first band. But you end up playing with the drummer's drums, you know, and
yeah.
So I played drums in that band, and then while I was in the Marine Corps, you know, I had a, you know, my instruments and stuff in my house, and you know, when I was able, I would take my guitar on deployment and whatnot, and you know, would always just plink around. But when I got out, you know, I told you I was working for the MARSOC Foundation. It's now the Marine Raider Foundation. I started working with them a couple months after I moved home, and I my job was to help build new partnerships and relationships and kind of find, you know, unique donor opportunities. And I was on Instagram, and I kept seeing this page for this guy named Brad Thomas. And he was what I knew was that at the time, and from what his social media story told me, was that he was a Army Ranger veteran of Mogadishu in Black Hawk Down. Ended up with the Delta Force for 12 years, retired from the Army, you know, at some point in the last several years, and had started a band with a guy named Jason Everman, who Jason is a bit of a folk legend in both
say the least,
rock and roll circles and military circles. So for those who don't know who he is, Jason is from Seattle. Jason is actually on the cover of Nirvana's Bleach album. And in the, liner jacket notes, ended up playing bass for Soundgarden for a while. Then went on to play in a band called Mindfunk out of New York, and then just decided that rock and roll was getting a little too neat for him. So he's going to do the most punk rock thing he could as a rock star and join the military. So he joined the army, became a Ranger, became a Green Beret, got out and. I had read this article about Jason Everman that was in maybe like the New York Times back in like 2012, 2013. I was in Afghanistan reading it. And so anyway, I see this Instagram page and I just send this, direct message to the account. And I say, look, this is my story. I'm a musician all my life, military, Naval Academy, Marine Corps, MARSOC, work for this foundation. You guys are doing this badass project with your band to like raise money for, charitable special operations organizations. Like, how can we, be a part of that? Like, what can we do to help support you so that we can maybe get some funds for our, for our community? And Brad hits me back and he's like, well, do you still play bass? I was like, yeah. And he's like, is that something you think you'd want to do? And I'm like, sure. And what's funny is, come to find out, like, this thing was still very much in its infancy. And so Brad and I started talking and started sending music back and forth. And then, the next thing you know, like, organically, our drummer shows up. Our drummer, Brandon, had been in the Marine Corps. He was a helicopter crew chief, was a HMX-1 crew member for a while, got out, played in a number of bands, to include a couple like hardcore bands. And then he actually toured as the drummer for a metal band called Shadows Fall. He's a really incredible and talented drummer. And then our singer, Fred, came along kind of through Brandon's, previous metal sort of connections. And Fred, our singer, is a senior enlisted Air Force veteran. And and so this thing came together and we just said, look, we just want to like record this album and play the music that we like. And we want to donate 100% of the money that we raise from this first record to some nonprofits that support, veterans and first responders. And we ended up landing on the Marine Raider Foundation and Warrior's Heart, which is an addiction treatment facility down in Texas. I think it's near San Antonio. It's actually founded by Tom Spooner, who is one of Brad's Delta Force buddies. And really amazing facility. It's like truly kind of cutting edge as those sorts of facilities go. As we start getting together and writing this music, I mean, we click instantly. And we have that, we have that mission focus, attack mindset. So we literally in 7 weekends wrote an album. Because we live in 5 different states, so it's like being in the reserves. 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year, get together, write a rock album with guys that, for me it's awesome because I did grow up appreciating the military. My mom's dad was a pilot in World War II, and so when I was a kid, I kind of knew what was out there. And I remember my dad reading Black Hawk Down shortly after it came out, and then. You find out like Brad was there, and then Dominic Pilla, who was the first casualty or first KIA in that battle, like Brad was in the vehicle with him. Was Brad's best friend. Yeah. Jeez. And so being so close to that story, and then Jason and as we've all become friends and write this music, you know, we'd kind of put some teasers out on social media. Well, then we got a message from a producer in Los Angeles named Josh Goodwin. And Josh was a Marine infantryman, spent most of his time out at Third Recon, I guess. And Josh sends us a message. Josh is an A-list producer. He actually is nominated for his second Grammy now. Wow. He won his first one last year. And he said, look, I'd love to help you guys, you know, however I can. And he opened up his schedule for us. We set up a budget. We flew out to Los Angeles. We recorded at Stag Street Studios in Van Nuys, California, and worked with an A-list producer. The studio engineer had worked with, you name it, he worked with him. He actually ended up working on a project with former members of Black Sabbath shortly after us. And, it was just incredible. And
the studio was a little bit better than a garage band setup, you're saying? So
it was nice. But you know, the coolest part about it is that it's been, nothing's ever truly completely effortless, but it's been mostly effortless for us. It took us a while to get that record out. It came out in December, not this past, but the year before, I guess. And then almost a full year after we recorded it, just because Josh was working on Justin Bieber's album that he is now subsequently, I think, nominated for a Grammy for. So he was, kind of busy. But this is like the ultimate story of veterans finding each other to create art in order to pass along a message that, like, look, I've been there, I've been where you've been. And we found each other to work on this thing, to just say, hey, there is light out there, And so the band is called Silence and Light, actually is a line from a poem. There's a British poet named Christopher Logue who rewrote the battle scenes from the Iliad. And I learned about him when I was in school getting that BS in English. really kind of geeked out on it. But Brad and I were going back and forth about, what should our name be? Like, we had written, some music at that point. We didn't know who we wanted to be. And I was looking through old pictures from Afghanistan, and there was this one from this position I was in, looking at a compound and the sun's coming up over this valley. And that phrase just kind of came to mind, and I shared it with him. And then I went and looked at the book, and then we kind of went back and forth and, looked to make sure we weren't like violating any laws or anything, and realized that like every band in the history of music has taken their name from somebody's, written work. So, we stuck with that. And it's been interesting because COVID really derailed some of our plans. We were going to get out and play some shows last summer, and we were starting to write a new record. And we finally all got together. So our original plan was to try and record, last month, kind of over the Christmas, New Year's holiday, sort of same time window we did previously. And, we decided to push it off. And we got together the next time, and Brad is our principal songwriter, right? He comes up with all the concepts, and then we get together, and he and Brandon and I just sort of figure it out. And then Fred puts the vocal piece into sort of what the final composition is. And the new stuff that was written as a result of that delay, like, pushed out all the old stuff right away. And Brad and I were just talking about this the other day, because our first album is kind of dark feeling, and I like to think of it as an album that you can follow it from start to finish. It's somebody who has just recently joined the service, and they're, eager and full of piss and vinegar and like ready to get after it. And then they go experience war and they feel invincible. And then there's loss, right? And then there's a little bit of grief and sort of reconciling sort of that admission of mortality, right? And then a little bit of numbness, and then introspection, and then the last song on the album is called Silence and Light, and I think it's probably one of the most beautiful songs we have. It's long, it's just got a feel to it, but I won't tell you how it makes you feel when it's over. You got to listen to it, but I love the way it ends, because there's no punctuation mark on it, and that's just so true to that life and that experience, right? Because we got to keep moving, we got to keep growing, and so when Brad and I were chatting the other day, he said, I just feel like that other stuff that we had been working on was still kind of stuck in where we were when we wrote that first album. And now this new stuff just feels more up, and it feels more like us now, and that's the beauty of art and music, kind of back to our conversation earlier, but the ability to express yourself and get those things out in whatever way comes naturally to you is the real answer, and being willing to do that and take those risks. And Brad does a great job of talking about how nervous he used to be about like sending his first song, because he'll record something on his iPhone and send it to me, and how nervous he was the first couple of times. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you're totally exposing yourself, and I'd come up with a bass line and send it back to him. And I'm like, oh God, he's going to think this sucks. Like, I'm not going to be in this band any longer. And, and now it's like, we got together a couple weeks ago, and first time we played any of the new stuff live, and we were like on it, and, we were woodshed some stuff, and next thing you know, we've all got chill bumps, and we're smiling at each other while we're just ripping through these songs. Like, we're having those flow moments, as a group.
That's cool.
And it's awesome. It's badass. So, well, that's the band. I'll make the plug, right? Our Instagram handle is Silence and Light Official. Our album is titled Volume One. It's out on all the major streaming services, Spotify, Apple Music, Pandora. But of note, if you buy the album on iTunes, you can also buy a hard copy CD. Amazon like manufactures a CD, so it doesn't have any album art except for like a one page insert thing, but you can buy a physical CD if that's your thing. 100% of the money from that purchase, which we don't have a distribution deal or anything, so if I forget what it comes out to, but I think we get about like 69 cents off the 99 cent cost per song, 100% of that purchase will go to the Marine Raider Foundation of Warriors Heart.
Awesome.
So, and we get our operating funds. We have a website, silenceandlightmusic.com. You can buy, we got a couple t-shirts on there, and some of those cool like old 1-inch rock and roll buttons, for your leather jacket and all that, and some stickers and stuff. But that's, we use that to generate our op fund to help us just fund buying these guitars and stuff that are sitting behind me, and not even that, just help them pay for studio time and things like that to put the next record together. So
nice. Well Tyson, I appreciate you coming on, and I'm sure we could probably talk to you for 6 or 8 hours, especially if we had more adult beverages and time, as we did on the mountain and as we did up here in the Philly area. But hopefully, maybe when the band goes out again, and we can talk to you again at some point. And it seems like as the Marine Corps gods would wish that I don't get to go to Hawaii like I was hoping for maybe my last duty station, but I probably will be, having fun on the East Coast, because it looks like I'm going to be in Virginia Beach area.
Oh, nice.
So I'll be there for the next 2 to 3 years. Hopefully when your band starts touring, obviously you're on the East Coast, and hopefully I see you out on the road and when this COVID thing lets up a little bit. And thanks for coming on, and that's all I've got. Yeah, I know we're like two buddies talking, as I thought it would be. The doc was a participant sometimes. So Bill, if you have any other closing thoughts or something you want to say to Tyson.
Well, first off, as far as the folks that we've interviewed on the WFO Life podcast, I would say that I took the most notes on this one, and you're an interesting dude. And I just the backstory, I enjoyed all the backstory and lead up and touching on kind of the high points. You're still a young guy, so I'm kind of I'm kind of glad that I've got to meet you and kind of interested in what you're going to be doing next. I think your mission that you're on right now is very powerful with the music. It's, like the way this kind of came together, kind of full circle. We will definitely, as a podcast, we're starting to get, quite a few downloads pretty regular. We've been doing this for a while. We will definitely continue to push this, your message. Everybody that we've interviewed or has some special mission that they're working on, we will continue to share it. So hopefully that'll grow and spread awareness of what you're doing and the service you're doing right now. So super cool. Pleasure to meet you, and I appreciate your generous time and chatting with us. And maybe, Chris and I are thick as thieves. Maybe we'll hang out one of these days.
Yeah, that sounds great. I really do appreciate it. And, like I said, I've done a handful of podcasts at this point, but, this was easily my favorite one. I'm not just saying that. I'm not one to blow smoke, but it's we ran, I think, probably longer than any of us expected. But
it's all good. It's all good. Yeah. Whatever needed to tell the story. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate what you had to say, Bill, because I feel like I've been on just an interesting journey so far, It has given me an opportunity to meet a lot of very different and very awesome people, and this podcast and, meeting Chris is another stop on the way. Right.
Yep.
And just adding to it. But I appreciate the time, and I appreciate you guys for this. So thanks.
Awesome. Thanks a lot. All right, man. Talk to you soon.